I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
Hello and welcome to Why Food Podcast. I'm your lone co-host today, Ethan Frisch. Jenny is not with us, but we do have an awesome guest who I'm really excited to talk to, and I think you'll really enjoy hearing about. Ben Jacobson, founder and CEO of Jacobson Salt Co. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ethan.
So, Ben, let's just dive right in. What's the story? How did Jacobson Salt happen?
I had never, I grew up with a mom as a cook who was a great cook and at home, but it was never fancy food. It was never plated or anything like that. Lots of casseroles and kind of family style meals. And as a result, never, and she wasn't aware of finishing salt, at least that I was aware of, growing up. And so we just kind of had, good family style meals, but nothing very fancy at all. And she's a wonderful cook and probably our biggest single customer right now, to date. I was living in Denmark and a girlfriend at the time, bought, a package of salt, a finishing salt, and, brought it home. And I was like, and we were students at the time. And so very clearly on a budget, and it was the equivalent of $10 or so, 30 kroner. And I was like, why did you spend $10 on salt? And she was like, just taste it. And I said, okay, obviously. And I did, and I was just blown away. And it sounds a little bit odd, I guess, but I was blown away by how good great salt can make very, very simple food. And from that point on, I became aware of it and used it every single chance I could do. But I moved to Norway for a job after I lived in Denmark and had a job where I traveled all over the world. And wherever I would go, I would try and seek out salt from that region because it was a small, inexpensive thing to bring back that I could eat on an everyday basis, and it was delicious. And kind of a sense reminded me of where I was and sense of place. And after I finished that job in Norway, moved back to Portland and realized that nobody in America was making great salt. And I thought that was strange. And so then I started trying to make salt, and my first attempt at making salt, I think, was buying a kiddie pool, at those discount stores and filling it up with salt water, putting it on the back patio in the sunshine, and then walking away from it for like 3 months, and nothing happened effectively. And at the end of 9 months of being there, I live in Portland, so it's hot in the summertime, but not hot the rest of the year. At the end of the time, salt was finally there, and it was salt. And anybody can make salt, but it's very difficult to make great salt consistently.
So what is great salt? When you were traveling and tasting salts from different countries, what were you looking for? Which salts really stand out to you now looking back?
Well, you have salts from all over the world, and they're all, we are Jacobson salt. We define by taste, texture, and color. And so taste, it tastes very clean and briny with no bitter aftertaste. Texture wise, it's very light and flaky. Then color, it looks like this kind of iridescent shaved ice, and it's just beautiful, and it tastes like the sea. Rather than a chemical. So if you taste like diamond crystal kosher salt, It'll like it'll almost bite your tongue back, or Morton's or what have you. It tastes like a chemical versus if you use, you know, a really good kosher salt or a really good finishing salt, it'll taste like the sea. And so that's, but you know, there are, it runs the gamut from different qualities of salt. Like you have a French sel gris that's super earthy and minerally, and it's why it's actually gray is because there's, you know, clay in the salt as well and other earth elements. And whereas you compare that with like a French fleur de sel, which is beautiful, and you can even get like Guatemalan fleur de sel now and everything else. And you know, it's a the first crystal to form on the surface of the salt brine fields. And it's delicate, it's light, it's, you know, just a little bit crunchy. It's really good. So different types of salts for different types of applications. But our salt is generally, you know, light and flaky and super briny.
Would you walk us through that salt making process? I think obviously everybody eats a lot of salt all the time, but I think most people don't understand where it comes from or how it's produced.
Yeah. Starting out the business, I was hauling seawater in a rented U-Haul truck several times a week to Portland.
Just tanks of seawater in the truck?
Effectively, yes.
Where were you getting the seawater?
For a good 9 months, I bucketed out seawater from Neatarts Bay. And Neatarts Bay is 85 miles west of Portland. It's beautiful, you know, marine estuary on the Oregon coast. And tens of millions of oysters and clams live there, and oysters being bivalve shellfish filter seawater on our behalf. And so you have oysters, clams, Dungeness crab it's loaded with. So it's just really, really bountiful. And but yet there's very little kind of marine traffic on it because it's a protected estuary. I was hand bucketing 5 gallon buckets.
Does that mean like going down to the water, filling up a bucket and carrying it back up to a tank or to the truck?
Yes.
Hand bucketing. It makes it sound so
It was ridiculous.
Sophisticated. Yeah.
It was most definitely not sophisticated. I was doing my own little CrossFit session. I was much more fit at that point. But anyway, I don't truck the water in from the bay anymore. We have an old oyster farm on at the very south end of Neatarts Bay, and we pump seawater in through a pretty unimpressive 2-inch PVC line. You go out there and it's not like it's just not all that much to see. So it's a 2-inch PVC line that we pump seawater in through, then we boil the seawater, and we boil it of course to remove some of the volume of the seawater, but most importantly to remove the calcium. It's that calcium that would give our salt a very bitter taste. But when you come out to see our facility in the Oregon coast, you'll see this hard calcium that we store. And right now we're giving it to chicken farmers in the area to harden chickens' eggshells, which sounds funny to say. So we remove this calcium from the salt water. Same calcium that, of course, oysters build their shells out of. And then we move it to very shallow stainless steel evaporation pans where salt crystals form slowly on the surface, then fall kind of gracefully like a leaf falling from a tree or a snowflake to the bottom of the pan. And then when we harvest the salt crystals off the bottom and let them drain and then dry and then sort and sift and pack them.
How do you know when a salt crystal is done? How do you know when that process is complete?
It's originally through trial and error. I spent 2.5 years trying to figure out, you know, how to make good salt consistently. And so that was part of the process that took 2.5 years. And now we have it pretty well timed out to where, you know, we know what type of salt crystal is going to form when and how long that might take. So it's just kind of by experience.
And what determines, I mean, there are a million different sizes and shapes and textures of salt crystal, whether it's, like you said, fleur de sel or sel gris or cubic salt or rock salt or pink salt. Like what accounts for all of those differences?
Time, temperature, minerality, the way the salt is made. Some, you know, Himalayan salt is mined from Pakistan primarily and mined and crushed or, you know, cut with bandsaws to make, you know, salt plates and what have you. it's really kind of the input plus the process that determines the output.
And it was a big jump to go from tasting this finishing salt in Denmark, traveling and tasting salt around the world, to then I'm going to start a salt company. How did that, what was that process like? Was there a decision that you made at some point, or did you sort of fall into it? Tell us that story.
Yeah, I mean, life is a weird journey. I moved back from Denmark, from Norway, to start a tech company. I thought it was a good idea. I still think it's a great idea, but I was really, really horrible at executing it.
What was the company?
It was a mobile app discovery thing, and it's those were kind of deep, dark days for me, but that company was a pretty painful 2.5 year journey of kind of downwards. And it was just a fantastic exercise in failure for me. And during that time I was making salt for fun because it was fun for me, and I could make something with my hands from seawater, and I just thought that was cool, and it was something that I really enjoyed. And so I, you know, began, you know, making more and more salt, and as I was making more and more salt and testing out different batches and, you know, processes and that sort of thing, my startup company began failing more and more quickly. And at the end of it all, it was July that kind of decided to fold it up. July 2011, and August 2011, I heard about a vendor fair from New Seasons. New Seasons, like a local Whole Foods for us. And over the course of 24 hours, I got a label together, very, very similar to what you see on our package today, and brought in a batch of salt, grabbed a tomato from my parents' garden, sliced it on the cutting board, sprinkled salt on the tomato, and then brought it into the vendor fair, and the buyer said, "I love it. I want a case for each store. How soon can you get it to me?" And I said, "Oh crap, I better start a business." Because at that point I hadn't even started the business.
So what did you do?
Salt hadn't been made in Oregon before, ever, since Lewis and Clark, let alone the Pacific Northwest, let alone really the West Coast, aside from industrial salt, you know, flats like Leslie and Cargill and that sort of thing that's primarily used for industrial purposes. And so I was kind of at a loss as to what to do, where to go, how to begin this thing. So I went to ODA, Oregon Department of Agriculture, and ODFW, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and proposed the idea, and their first kind of reaction, rightfully so, was like, "You want to do what?" But then I gave them examples of other salts that were produced in other countries that, you know, this is a thing. Yes, I'm a little bit crazy, but I'm not delusional. And so that was really it. And so over the course of the next 30 days, I had to, because of the order, New Seasons, this customer, wanted the salt in 30 days. And so started the business, got all my licensing, you know, signed off on and everything. And that was, you know, frankly, of course, the state's first reaction was like, "You can't do that," or like, "That's never been done before." But they were and they have been very supportive, and just helping us along and understanding kind of that this is a burgeoning industry. I mean, I just think I love the company that we've created and the product and the salts that we create. But this is an industry that simply did not exist in America before. I mean, we employ now 44 people, which is crazy. And we're the first to do so since Lewis and Clark, which I think is pretty neat.
Why is that? Why haven't other people done this?
I think salt is easy to overlook. I overlooked it. My mom overlooked it. My, you know, friends and family overlooked it for my entire life up until I was 33 years old. And so like, I didn't know any better. I didn't know it could be better. And, I think it's just a commodity that's taken for granted traditionally. And, you know, before the Industrial Revolution in America, salt was not a commodity. And while it wasn't prized to the extent that, you know, it was in the you know, Middle Ages, where it was traded ounce for ounce with gold, it wasn't yet a commodity. And so after the Industrial Revolution, it meant that, you know, salt could be produced much more efficiently, obviously, and effectively. And as a result, you know, food could stay fresher longer all around the world. And so I think I truly just feel like it was kind of an overlooked industry that and an overlooked ingredient. But I think that that's also the beauty of it, is it's something you need every single day. It's something you physically have to have to survive. And, you know, we sweat and we pee every single day. And when we do that, we're excreting salt, and we have to have some way to get that salt back into our bodies.
I read Mark Kurlansky's book not too long ago, which I'm sure you have some thoughts on, but kind of ties in the history of human civilization with access to salt for preserving food, for health purposes, obviously, for moving people and armies and expanding civilization. I don't know. If you have any thoughts on the book, feel free to weigh in. But
I mean,
but
I love his writing. I'm not a huge fiction fan, but nonfiction, which is what he obviously does, is, and I find everything that he writes just incredibly fascinating. And it's just, he tells such a brilliant narrative, you know, throughout history of these essential ingredients or food staples or foodstuffs, and you know, from salt to cod to oysters to whatever. And it's like, I would love to meet him someday.
So what do you think is the sort of update to that book? Like how do you see Jacobson's changing the narrative for salt today?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, Kurlansky is certainly a pioneer in kind of educating people on the importance of essential ingredients for life. And we make essential ingredients for life, and we make them, I believe we make some of the best salt on the planet. And I say that kind of unashamedly, but it's also the way I pay for my groceries, and the way 43 other employees pay for their lives and their houses and that sort of thing. And I truly do think we make an incredibly, really delicious salt. You know, I think our job is to continue to advance good food in America. And salt being, you know, the mineral that you have to survive. Yes, it's cost more than, you know, a cheap iodized salt, but it's also, you know, 10 times more delicious and, nutritious than a bad salt. And so, you know, when you're making a dish of food at home, it might cost you a penny to put, you know, salt in your food for that dish. And it might cost you 2 pennies to put salt in your food using our salt. But we're also a much smaller company. And it's salt is something that, you know, you might as well eat the best if you can. And so I think my goal is to make our salt and good salt available to as many people, around the world as possible.
Let's talk more about the process of building the business. So how long have you been in business?
Just at our 7th anniversary.
Wow. So over the course of 7 years, to have gone from you bucketing salt out of the bay to now 44 employees and national distribution. And how did that happen? How did you put that together? What lessons had you learned from your previous startup or jobs before that helped you make that happen?
I learned a lot from this previous failure of mine, and that was to not try and do what I wasn't great at, and or not try and do what didn't give me energy, and running my accounting through a spreadsheet and you know, Microsoft Word was not a very efficient way or effective way. And so as soon as I could, I hired a bookkeeper, because bookkeeping for me took energy rather than gave me energy. And really hopefully just trying to focus on what gives me energy and what I'm best at rather than what I'm worst at, and trying to make those better. And because at my previous company, I really kind of tried to do everything, and I wasn't very good at anything, honestly. And so this was, you know, I was kind of in dire straits. I was just getting going through a divorce at the time, and I had no money, and I had to make this work. And we're not out of business yet.
What were those first steps after you'd gotten this customer, in conceptualizing how you were going to build the business? What were the first steps you took? And looking back today, how your vision for the business, how closely have you adhered to that 7 years later?
First steps that I took, I mean, it was really just about survival. You know, the first probably 3 to 4 years, it was, you know, I hired somebody so I could sleep overnight, because it's salt making is a continuous process. So I had to hire somebody so I could get a night of sleep. So that was about survival. And then, you know, a year and a half, 2 years down the road from that, I hired a delivery driver who's still with us today, but she's doing a bunch of other great things for us. But hired a delivery driver so that I could take a weekend off because I hadn't had a weekend off in years. And so it was more just kind of trying to do everything and hustle to all make it work. But beyond that, it's just been a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of hard work, trying to make the puzzle pieces work. I remember working with my brother very early on, trying to create a business model for the salt company, and that was tricky. So we were, you know, knee deep in Excel spreadsheets and everything else, and we were trying to calculate the cost of moving seawater versus the cost of doing it, of condensing it in a more efficient form, and stuff that I knew nothing about, but just trying to kind of plot our way through that. And then, you know, finally, like you hopefully have some money to, you know, to hire great people around you. And I've been able to hire fantastic people. And I think, you know, we have a fantastic team, and we have a team that's committed to, that wants people to eat and live better through great food. And I think that means a lot. And I think it shines through to our customers and everything that we do. My most recent hire was a woman named Mary Ellen Signer. She came from Stumptown Coffee and grew their business and was effectively running the show there for 10 years. And I can't tell you how good it is to have somebody that solid as a partner, and just that she's... The way I've talked about her before is she's just bulletproof. She's just like, she knows every facet of the business. She gets it. She uses the salt at home for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And she's really great at QuickBooks Enterprise and, like, you know, operations, and exceptionally good with people. And so it's just hiring the best people possible as quickly as possible when you can afford them was good. And then also taking care of our employees, you know, it was very important to me that I, you know, had moved from Scandinavia prior to this, and Scandinavia had an emergency appendectomy, and I was rushed into the hospital. I had been at work, and then spent the next 6 days in the hospital, and I was, of course, you know, the surgery hurt, but it wasn't the end of the world. They took care of it, you know, really well, but I was worried because I was sleeping 6 nights in the hospital. Like, what's this going to cost? And I asked the nurse, and I remember to this day, she said, "Your only job here is to get better. There is no bill." And that meant a lot to me. And so as soon as we could afford it, we started to pay for all of our employees' health insurance. And that's pales in comparison to a socialized healthcare system, and it's probably been to our detriment from a cash flow perspective, but I feel like it's a commitment to our employees, and it's a commitment to their well-being and their stability, which I feel like every person on the planet deserves.
I feel like that pr- process of hiring people, knowing when to hire people, is something that a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with. It's kind of too easy, especially in the early days, to take on all of the burden and you know, run yourself out pretty quickly. How did you know who to hire? How did you know what skills you were able to give away, or what aspects of the business you were able to give away, and what things you needed to keep for yourself?
I definitely knew I needed to get a finance person. I mean, that was just clear from the beginning and made no illusions about that. And so I've hired for that position and given away as, or, you know, empowered as, and given control to that, to those folks as much as possible. I've also made some bad hires of folks that probably just weren't good for a good fit for our company, but very smart, you know, independently and hardworking, but just not, not a fit for us. But by and large, I think we've done a good job at keeping and, or attracting and keeping, really good talent. I hold a certain small source of pride. Like, we hired this one guy, who had worked in went to a great school in Portland, but worked in restaurants in Portland, you know, and, we hired him as a project manager initially, and started him at $10 an hour, which is all I could afford. And he now owns his own house, in Portland, and, he's not making $10 an hour anymore. And he's our operations manager. And to me, that's just neat to see, you know, the growth, not only from a professional standpoint, but from him as a person. Like, he's beginning to grow up with us. And to me, it just makes me really happy and proud.
We're going to take a quick break, a word from one of our sponsors, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Not only because I use it constantly, but because cabinet space is at a premium in New York City kitchens. My boyfriend and I were gifted our Le Creuset by his family last Christmas, and it was the first piece of enameled cookware we'd ever owned. I'd been fawning over the marine blue color, especially when I realized there were only a few left in stock. When we unwrapped the box, we were pleasantly surprised to see how big this thing was. I immediately started imagining what I could cook. Roast chicken, Texas-style chili, a leg of lamb, or my favorite, a huge batch of Marcella Hazan's bolognese. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET.com/HRN, to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food Podcast with Ben Jacobson, the founder and CEO of Jacobson Salt. We were just talking about the process of building the business. Let's talk about next steps. Where do you see the business going? What are your aspirations over the next 5 or 7 or 10 years into the future?
I think that everybody in America deserves great salt, and everybody across the planet does. And so I think we need to do a better job and at getting our salts, making our salt available to as many people as possible. And I think our salts is a, but we're growing, and we've grown tremendously every year, but we have to grow in the right way. And that involves continuing to work with great chefs, from chefs that own food carts to chefs that, you know, have a whole team at, you know, a Michelin star restaurant, to James Beard award-winning chefs, to neighborhood chefs, you know, just down the street, who have a small family and are struggling to survive but want to provide great food. So working with hopefully great chefs of all calibers and all, you know, all recognition levels across the country, but then also beginning to work with more and more specialty shops around the country. You know, our biggest customer at one point was Williams-Sonoma, and which is a wonderful partner, and they really, you know, brought us from this little kid in Oregon to, you know, a brand that's maybe not known, but at least recognized around the country. And because our salt is available in, you know, all of their stores around the country. And so that's been a huge support. And that's, so I think going after and building partnerships with small regional natural grocery chains around the country would be our kind of obvious next step, and just continuing to build our presence in there.
It seems like, at least from the outside, that you've done something that a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with or have not been able to accomplish, which is selling a comparable product through lots of different channels, right? To chefs at restaurants of all kinds, through Williams-Sonoma, retail, maybe your own direct-to-consumer. I don't know if that's a meaningful part of your business, but how do you balance those different, essentially different business models within a single business?
That's tricky. That's why I have Mary Ellen. as a small business, cash flow is everything. And good example of that is, you know, you might be accepted into this, you know, large grocery chain, even though it's a good fit for your business. It's very expensive to get into those chains, both from an inventory perspective, but also from a spend perspective. Talking thousands of dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars per SKU, to be able to kind of buy your placement in there. And which means that effectively there's no gross profit in the first year, sometimes longer. And so while we want to grow as well as we can, as quickly as we can, we also have to take a very measured approach. And that is making sure our brand shows up in the right places, so that people care enough. But then also balancing that with, you know, some specialty grocery growth, that while it is expensive, it's also necessary. But realizing that, you know, if we had $100 million, yes, we could go out and buy placement everywhere. But that's not number one, that's not possible for us to do that. And two, it's just not, you know, it's not sustainable, because then you run the risk of, like, you know, you can get the salt in there, you can get your product in there, but does it actually sell? And so we just need to continue spreading our brand and just growing it slowly and helping people understand the importance of great salt.
And how do you feel like your brand fits in with all of, I mean, there's no shortage of salts and iodized, chemically produced. How do you feel like people see you, and how much control do you have really in distinguishing your brand from all of the others?
I guess we don't have much control.
I mean, that wasn't necessarily my suggestion.
Yeah.
But being in such a crowded space, I mean, even mm-hmm. coffee, I'm like, you're mentioning the person you hired recently, like, that's similarly a really crowded market to be in. How do you make a brand stand out when there are so many other, maybe not as good or different, but other options available?
I think that's a really, really good question. I mean, I think from the very beginning, we've really, really focused on our brand. And I think, you know, product design and packaging is extremely important, and hoping that product design and packaging conveys kind of your ethos and your product's quality is incredibly important, and making sure that also stands out on the shelf. Like, you look at the salt, you know, industry, and aside from Maldon from the UK, who's been around 140 some years, to a couple of French fleur de sel manufacturers, it's difficult to name a single brand of premium finishing salt. And I think outside of Jacobson, of course, and I think I see that as an opportunity, because you think of, well, I can't even think of paper towels, but like, you've got Brawny, you've got whatever else, and like, but you've got a number of different alternatives there that the average consumer, I'm probably not an educated consumer in that regard, but can probably name. But the salt category was, I saw, as fairly wide open from a brand perspective. And so I think paying attention to your brand and your packaging, and ultimately the quality of the product that you're putting out that people talk about or don't talk about, is critical.
And was that a conscious decision that you made when you started the company? You recognized that there was this brand gap in salt, or is that something you figured out as you went?
Kind of figured out as I went. And then you know, that snowball starts rolling, and then you kind of gain a little momentum, and you hopefully pay more and better and closer attention to your brand. And, you know, a good example of that is we don't sell salt, our salt that we produce, for repackaging. It's very easy to distribute and sell salt and, you know, repack salt, but not everybody on the planet can make salt. And if we were to sell our salt for, you know, redistribution and repackaging, I feel like we would just be commoditized and then compared against everything else. We can't compete with that from a financial perspective, and from a brand perspective, our products are better than that. And so, as a result, we want people to have the whole experience.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I'm trying to figure out with my company. I think this is a thing, something that a lot of entrepreneurs try to figure out, is this like private label discussion, or how important is my brand versus building my business when you have a big customer come along and say, I want to buy a very large quantity of this, but I'm going to do it under my own brand. It's very hard to say no to that kind of opportunity, especially given all of the cash flow issues around starting a small food business. And that transition from commodity to specialty is tricky. It's tricky in an industry like salt, where it's completely a commodity, almost completely a commodity, and trying to convince people that it is worth a little bit more to use something better. Do you have any? What have been the more creative or wonkier or funnier ways that you've figured out to convince people of that, to move salt from commodity to specialty?
Well, I remember our first kind of small consumer package of salt was I was selling it out of a commercial kitchen, out of the back parking lot of our commercial kitchen in Portland, and I was selling it in little tiny plastic bags, and they looked like dime bags, and with this white substance in them. And Gregory Gourdet, a chef from Portland, Oregon, who now also has a restaurant in Denver, bought a ton of them, and I was so grateful and humbled and fortunate to meet him. And he, and then a few other chefs came by that day as well. But like, I think that's a very good example of the type of packaging not to use. It didn't do the product or the brand justice. But I think that we work hard on just kind of hopefully having our packaging have a very special feel, and but hopefully that doesn't, you know, it can't impact the bottom line too much.
And you've branched out from just your straight up salt to a lot of other things, other flavored salts. Tell us about that process. How did you come up with those flavors? How did you make them? How do they compare in your eyes and in the eyes of your customers with your original product?
It's funny. The reason I did that was because I needed capital and got a Kickstarter campaign approved, and it's funny. I reconnected with one of the original guys at Kickstarter recently, who now works at this apparel company, Outdoor Voices. And he said he remembers our project going through kind of their editorial committee, and it was at first rejected because it was a business. So I was like, there's so many other businesses out there that are doing this, but I really needed the capital for the business. And we were finally approved, fortunately. And you know, of course, as part of, you know, successful Kickstarter campaigns, you generally give some sort of incentive. And I had to come up with some incentive. So I made a denim hat that the first one I got done at a mall, one of those like little hat embroidery places in the mall. but it was great, and they were super, super helpful. So the first hat I got done in a mall in Portland. Then I need to come up with some other things. And so I just decided to make infused salt. So my friend John Groshaw, who lent me both his forklift and his wine totes to collect the seawater, is a winemaker, and we used to race bicycles together a long time ago, and we've been friends for years. And he's got a very successful, very delicious winery now, and so we made a Groshaw Cellars Pinot Noir salt, using his Pinot Noir and our salt to make a delicious salt. But our first attempt at that actually was putting salt water in a barrel and then trying to extract color and flavor from that and then making salts. And we tried that and it was terrible. So live and learn. But our first core set of infusions, from vanilla bean to lemon zest to Groschau Cellar's Pinot Noir to, forget what else. I think we did a smoke salt, our first set, was due to the fact that I needed to give something special to the people who were giving me a livelihood.
And the later iterations of those, of the other salts?
And the later iterations, yeah, they're honestly just fun. You can do anything. Salt is one of those core central ingredients, so it's pretty fun to be able to riff on. We have a Stumptown coffee salt that's really good. We use concentrated cold brew coffee and then finely ground hairbender and spray the cold brew coffee over the salt and then apply the hairbender and then repeat that 3 times. But the salt is damp from the seawater when we apply the cold brew. So it is able to take in even more of that coffee flavor. And that's actually one thing that really makes us unique, is that because we're salt makers from seawater, we can infuse salt like no other because the salt is still damp as we infuse the salt. And that's a pretty special part of the process. So Stumptown Cold Brew is great. We make a Guittard chocolate salt, which is phenomenal. Amy Guittard of Guittard is a really good friend and just super supportive. We've made a Red Boat fish sauce salt, which had a certain appeal, not to many people.
And how do people use those? How do you use those, or what's the optimal application for a chocolate salt?
Chocolate salt's really good on on ice cream, on a steak. The Stumptown coffee salt is excellent on roasted acorn squash with butter and brown sugar, and just has those really rich kind of fall flavors, and it's super easy to do. Our vanilla bean salt is delicious on seared scallops and stone fruit like nectarines and peaches and stuff like that.
That sounds great. As we wrap up, what are some of the key pieces of advice that you would give to aspiring or early stage food entrepreneurs who are looking to build businesses comparable to what you've built?
Work your ass off. Don't be afraid of folks that discourage you or when you were discouraged. Keep your head down and keep focused and focus on what you're best at. I think is my biggest lesson that I've learned, and find people who care about what you do, because a lot of people won't care, and that's okay because people are busy living their lives. But find people who care about what you do and lean on them and give them energy and have them give you energy, and smile and be nice and get people health insurance as quickly as possible.
Ben, it's been such a pleasure having you join us today. Tell our listeners where they can find your salts and where they can learn more about you and your work.
Thank you, Ethan. It's been a lot of fun. I want to go have some pizza after this.
We're sitting looking out through the window into the Roberta's main dining room and
it's pretty
watching
cool.
Everybody eat pizza.
Yeah, you can find our salt at jacobsonsalt.com and at great specialty shops all around the country. And at Williams-Sonoma stores all around the country as well. So
great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Why Food Podcast. I'm Ethan Frisch. You can find me on Instagram via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel. And you can find us at Why Food Podcast on Instagram. As always, email us, whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.